Welcome to the Podlet, serving up bite-sized tastes of the best theology. I'm your host, Megan Westra. Grab a plate and let's dig in. Hey, and we're back. Welcome again to another episode of the Podluck. I'm your host, Megan Westra. Thank you so much for being here today. We are winding down this first season of the Podluck. We are at episode 7 today. So we've had 6 different guests come on and answer the question, what does it mean to be saved? I give you a little bit of like background or verbiage that may be helpful for you to know in the preseason. So if this is your first time tuning in, then make sure you go back to those preseason episodes and get nice and grounded in the conversation. Those episodes are all between 5 and I think the longest one is like 15 minutes. So they're pretty short, but we'll just help you get grounded in this conversation so that you can draw your conclusions or grapple with the content that the guests are presenting in a really faithful and helpful way. So, but I've really enjoyed getting to hear from all these different people, and so have you. So just to read a few reviews that have come through on iTunes, Word Bird says that the Podluck does a great job of presenting multiple viewpoints without telling you which one is right or wrong. It brings unity through acknowledging that many diverse and sometimes conflicting perspectives have biblical, historical, and contemporary support, which encourages me to know that we don't need to figure it out or find a final answer. I especially appreciate the open-minded presentation of theologies I've been taught or that were stigmatized in the denomination of my childhood. So thanks for the review, Wordbird. Also from Historically, a wonderful podcast. Even if you aren't a theology nerd, I'm so glad there are some not theology nerds that are out here hanging out with me. Megan Westra does an excellent job of breaking down big theological concepts into bite-sized pieces. She welcomes all to her table. She allows her guests to talk uninterrupted and doesn't question or belittle their views. This is definitely just like a potluck. She allows the listener to sample many viewpoints. Give it a listen. So I want to thank you all so much for leaving reviews. We're at 26 different reviews right now. Anytime that you leave a rating or a review in iTunes, that helps other people find the Podluck. So if you are enjoying this podcast or you've benefited from it in some way, or you just find me wildly entertaining, then go ahead and leave a review. I know that it takes a few minutes. It takes more clicks or more taps on your phone to get through to the screen where you review or where you leave a review or a rating. I know that not everybody feels really confident in their ability to like string some words together, but that's cool. Even if you're just like, this is great, please listen. That helps. It puts us up in the algorithm and all of those fun things so that other people can find the Podluck, which is great. So today our guest is Karen Gonzalez. Karen is an author and a speaker and a fellow Enneagram aficionado. That's how I met. Karen was doing some work around the Enneagram, which is like the best way to definitely become my friend is to talk about the Enneagram. Karen is the author of the book, The God Who Sees, which came out this past year on Herald Press, which is also my publisher. The God Who Sees, which is Immigrants, the Bible, and the Journey to Belong. It is a fantastic book, and I cannot recommend it highly enough, especially as there have been so many headlines and so much news in the last year about immigration and immigration reform here in the United States. And Karen brings so much, not just clarity from a biblical perspective, but from her experience, from legal perspectives all around. And it's just beautifully woven together. Such a good read. So please pick that up. I'll put a copy, not a copy of the book. I'll put a link to the book in the show notes so that you can pick it up. She is a graduate of Fuller Theological Seminary, a former public school teacher. She studies missiology and theology, and she's worked for the last 11 years in the nonprofit sector, serving immigrants and refugees and working to get to help people access what they need in those respective areas. She lives in Baltimore, Maryland, and she has a cat named Scully, which is adorable. I haven't ever personally met Scully, but I appreciate the Instagram pictures of Scully. So I'll drop links to Karen's website, the book, The God Who Sees, and her social media in the show notes. Please follow along with her work. I have learned so much from her, and I hope that you learn a lot from her today as she answers our question, what does it mean to be saved?
What does it mean to be saved? I think at different times in my life, I would have answered that question very differently. I was born into the Catholic Church, where salvation, or my experience of the Latin American Catholic Church, was that salvation was a communal effort. You were baptized as an infant into the church. In fact, it's critical that you be baptized, especially if they think your life is in danger. You are initiated into the faith, and then you confirm that you receive that faith when you're old enough to do that. And that was really my understanding of faith for many years. And when I became an evangelical Christian, that belief shifted to one that was strictly very personal. Receiving faith at a very personal level, asking Jesus into my heart, and then beginning a process of sanctification. And this process included becoming a better person. And I abandoned the Catholic view of salvation in favor of this conservative evangelical view. And for some time that was satisfactory. It was okay. But there came a point at which I began to question that, because it began to feel to me like, well, if the purpose is just for me to be a slightly better person, to have fewer, you know, bad thoughts or be a little less selfish, I did see the value in that. It's not as if I thought, well, that's worthless. But it seemed incomplete. It seemed very limited. And so when I was in Kazakhstan and Russia, you know, I lived in the former Soviet Union for a time. This is when that crisis began for me, because I began to see that my friends who lived in what in the U.S. would be considered poverty and wanted a better life, they didn't really seem to care about things like just being a slightly better person today. They looked around at their country and saw how much corruption there was, how much suffering there was, even in their history. You know, it had been a city started by Stalin specifically to make people suffer and work them until they died. And so all these things that I've been taught to value, including apologetics, like how do we convince people to adopt our view of salvation and begin to pursue that, it just didn't work in that context. And for me, that created a real crisis, because if the gospel doesn't work everywhere, then is the gospel real? And so that time really set me on a journey toward, well, what does it mean to be saved if people here don't care about this? They don't care about having one less bad thought, or having, you know, saying one less terrible thing to someone that isn't a value for them. Like, they want their world changed, the community to be transformed. And so when I went to seminary, I began to learn more about that. And I think it's the first time that I was introduced to the idea that salvation as this personal relationship with Jesus was actually a relatively new idea. It had not always been so. In fact, what I had learned in the Catholic Church when I was a kid up until I was about 18 was actually what the church believed for centuries. In fact, in Acts, when the head of a household is baptized, the entire household is baptized, because it's as if initiating the entire household into that faith. Another thing that happened is I just began to see that, this is going to sound really arrogant and obnoxious, but I just began to see that evangelical Christians didn't really seem to understand what the sacraments were for. You know, there was so much of a tie between baptism and being saved, whereas historically that hadn't been the case, and it hadn't been the case in my experience either. My parents initiated me into the church, but they never intended that that was it. For them, that was the beginning, and it was my decision then, as I grew older, to then accept that faith and confirm it and continue to choose it and to grow. And even the way that we read the Bible in the Catholic Church was communal. You know, people in the Catholic Church, at least in my own experience in Guatemalan Catholic Catholicism, not everybody has their own Bible and their own little study Bible. It's like the Bible is for communal processing, communal learning, with clergy or with lay people, depending on, you know, who is guiding the study. But it's never meant to be this solitary thing where you try to find some little nugget for the day without fully understanding the full context of what the passage or the letter or whatever document it is that you're looking at in the Bible is saying. And that's how I had been taught to read the Bible in the evangelical church. So what ended up happening for me was a return of sorts of recognizing that actually the ideas of salvation I had been introduced to as a little girl were actually more in line with what I believe now. Additionally, there was this aspect of not just salvation for the self, but salvation for the community. Like, it wasn't just about me becoming better, although that was part of it, but it was also about how do we bring salvation to our people, to our community. And so that really shifted for me. I think also being introduced to the idea, I always thought substitutionary atonement was the only way to think about salvation, because that's what I've been taught in the evangelical church. And I didn't know what it was that I learned in the Catholic Church. I didn't have a name. All I had heard was that, oh no, Catholics aren't real Christians. That's what I've been told, which now I think is so ridiculous that I believe that even for a time, because that was literally the church out of which the Protestant church emerged. So they're the people who, you know, carried the faith and the scriptures for the Western church for so long. So I also began to see that there was a lot of American culture wrapped up in this idea of salvation being just for the self alone, for the personal relationship with Jesus and not going to hell. And I think as I began to question a lot of these different things, well, now I don't know what I think about hell. I actually have been struggling through that. And if salvation isn't to save us from hell, then what is it for? And that's where I began to see, well, it's about the kingdom of God. That's what salvation is for. It's not just about some future time where we're just going to walk on clouds and play a harp, but it's about a communal, you know, transformation here and now, bringing the kingdom here. It's not an escape. It's here and now. So, Yeah. Anyway, as I process through, oh, I don't know what I believe about substitutionary atonement, because it sounds very similar to actually what a lot of ancient pagan gods did, you know, demanded a blood sacrifice, and it just never sat well with me. I just remember even singing through songs like "It's the Blood That Makes Me Clean," and just kind of wondering about all of that and why God would demand a blood sacrifice. And so, you know, I haven't arrived. I know that there's a lot of theories out there, like Christus Victor, or, you know, I know there's, I think the one I agree with the most is just reading a lot of what N.T. Wright says about salvation history. That resonates with me powerfully, but I haven't arrived at a theory, I guess. And I'm not sure that it's really important, other than I no longer feel the pressure to evangelize in the way that I used to. And I used to do that, and now I look back on that very shamefully, just because I knew that that's all I knew at the time. But pressuring people to accept this personal savior that didn't have any impact on the community, but that was supposed to, as each individual heart was changed. And I just never saw the fruit of that pan out. It seemed that we needed a both and. So it's not really that I think evangelicals were all wrong, but I think it was incomplete, this idea of being saved and what it means. So this is some of the thoughts that I've had around it, sort of historically, and where I've arrived now. I don't want to make the mistake of thinking being saved is just for the community. It's just for the transformation of unjust systems. But I think that that's very important, and that's a big part of it. I also think it should be for the self. I'm part of the community too. Right? Going to affect with my whole self, right? The way that this community is. I'm going to contribute toward its health or its unhealth if I'm not, quote unquote, saved. So I think both matter to me today, and I don't want to put too much weight on just the self, because I think that that's just has not had a good result in so many ways. I think it's fed into sort of our capitalist thinking and to this whole idea of the individual being of most importance, which I don't think is good or healthy. And trying to separate that from faith is really hard, because we're cultural. We carry our culture with us. So yeah, that's where I've landed on all this.
That's good. I'm wondering, in all your experiences, you know, being in Kazakhstan and then at seminary, your family history coming from Guatemala and things like that, are there like examples where you have seen the personal and the communal held together really well? Because I think that that's something that is hard for people to grasp, especially when they're coming out of this like really individualistic framework. And sometimes I think that like case studies or examples can be helpful to help people get their hands around it.
Yeah, totally. And I have. Actually, one of the most powerful examples that I can think of is Father Oscar Romero, the Archbishop of El Salvador. And, excuse me, went away. Anyway, it was one of the earliest things that I experienced in terms of faith awakenings in this journey with God, is that I remember reading about Archbishop Romero's life. He was a very pious man. He was this sort of quiet, bookish person, and he loved God and was deeply committed to simplicity and humility and spiritual practices. And he had this very rich and vibrant faith. And when he was made Archbishop of El Salvador, he then took that personal faith that he held and he used it to impact the entire community. And some of the ways that he really changed things for so many people in Latin America, and I was living still in Guatemala, my family didn't migrate until after he died, is that he would, in Mass, every week, he would read the names of everyone who had disappeared or who had been found tortured and murdered. He would organize the poor in particular, and he would speak out to the rich in his community, which, you know, in Central America, it's run largely by these wealthy families. The oligarchy runs things. And he would, even though he was a privileged person in many ways, because he was educated and he could have, you know, sort of chosen a comfortable life, he chose instead to side with the poor, to elevate their voices, to seek systemic change for the poor in El Salvador, including things like land reform, like their own participation in democracy, like calling for a just government that didn't terrorize its citizens, calling, he wrote letters to Jimmy Carter at the time. So I saw the way that he married a personal faith with a communal faith extremely well. It was very costly to him. I mean, in the end, he was murdered by the state. But while he lived in that tension really well. I think that's, it's an extremely difficult thing. You know, I was talking with a friend of mine about Kierkegaard, who talks about the leap of faith. And what he says is that faith exists in the leap. Like, your faith in God exists in that leap. But it's very difficult to exist in the middle of a leap in the air. And so most of us land on one side or the other, because that tension is so hard to hold. And so I believe Archbishop Romero held that tension very well. And he still practiced, he still lived a life that many of us would say he engaged daily in spiritual practices, he engaged in prayer, he, you know, preached to the people, he participated in the sacraments. He didn't abandon any of those things for the work of justice. And so, yeah, it's a beautiful tension to live in, but I do agree that it's hard. And I think as we're growing in faith, as I have grown anyway, I should only speak for myself, it has been hard for me to sort of return to that tension. I used to be so focused on personal faith and so proud of doing daily devotions and all of the of caring about communal transformation and communal salvation so much that I sort of need to come back to the center to live in the tension of having both. Certainly there are other people who've also done this, but I always think of him when, of Archbishop Romero, when I think of this is sort of the model life, you know, to live.
This has been The Podluck. Thanks so much for tuning in again today as we've continued to grapple with the question, what does it mean to be saved? Y'all, just a few more episodes to go. I have so enjoyed this journey with you. So please make sure that if you enjoyed this episode, you can share it with friends on social media using at Podluck Podcast on Twitter or at The Podluck Podcast on Instagram. You can also share it on Facebook. There's a Facebook page for The Podluck as well. Please leave a rating or a review as that helps other people who aren't even your friends find out about The Podluck. You can support The Podluck by supporting us on Patreon. I'll put the link to that in the show notes. For as little as $1 a month, you get access to a Slack channel where people are discussing this and other ideas. For more than $1 a month, there's some other goodies, I will tell you that as this season winds down, I'm starting to format our recipe book. So if you would like a collection of the transcripts of all the episodes from this season in the classic spiral binding that is made popular by church cookbooks from years past, oh yes, we're doing that. So there will be recipe books going out. So like essay, recipe. Those will be going out as this season winds down. There will also be some mugs that are going out, some Podluck mugs. So if that's interesting to you, check out the Patreon and join in and support the Podluck and the production. And then rate, review, share, support on Patreon, and listen next week. That's all I've got for you. There will be another episode going up early next week before the holiday. I'll be traveling to visit some family. And if you, like me, are going to be spending a lot of time on the road, I want to make sure that you have something to listen to. So there'll be a shorter gap, maybe to make up for all of the 2-week breaks that have been happening this season. So some weeks there's 2 weeks between episodes. This week there's going to be like 4 days between episodes. But that's what happens when, you know, you do this in your spare time. So anyway, watch for a new episode next week and tune in then. Until then, I'm your host, Megan Westra. This has been The Podluck. Join us next time, grab a plate, and dig in.